the Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts, one of the gifts to your ears today, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I am another one of your gifts today, maybe one you might want to return. I'm Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
I don't have anything funny. I'm Michael Scavarla with Penn State University, your last host today.
And we're so excited that you've chosen to join us again for another exciting episode of Arthropod, where we will be talking about some really cool insect biology. Our show today is being charted. Our course is being charted by Dr. Green. And I'm just going to kind of turn over the hosting duties to her and let her take us on a magical tour of nuptial gifts.
Yeah, so today we're going to talk about nuptial gifts. I am not known for doing any scripted shows, mostly because I don't write scripts. And if I do write a script, I'm really bad at following them. But I'm going to try my best to follow what I did write down. So we are going to talk about these gifts. So, you know, normally when we think about a gift, it's something that is like a voluntary transference of property. Maybe it was yours, maybe it wasn't. Who knows whose property it is? But we're going to talk about that in terms of the insect world or the arthropod world. So let's just say it is presenting a gift from one partner to another. It could be during a ceremony. So if we think about humans, we may think of like a wedding or a marriage. So did either of you provide your then to be your future wife prior to marriage with a nuptial gift according to this definition?
I was going to let Mike go first.
Oh, I didn't know if your finger was like, pick me.
I'll point to Mike.
Okay, I think Mike. Throwing it over to me.
Do you want to think about it?
I mean, we did all the kind of standard stuff. Like, here's a ring that's expensive and has a diamond in it. We were talking before the show, like, here's some flowers that I gave my wife on our second date. There was gift giving.
But how did you pick those gifts? Like, is it true that someone, I didn't really know this at the time, but you're supposed to have like a 3-month salary for the ring?
Oh,
because,
wow.
Like, as a grad student, I mean, it's not a lot.
Ring.
It's not a lot, but that sure is 3 months worth of not a lot of other things, right?
Oh. So
like, are those the kind of things you think about when it comes to like buying flowers? Are you thinking about the kind of flowers? Are you thinking specifically what she may like? The bigger, the better, more in season? Like, what kind of things do you think about?
Sure. Really subjective, I would argue, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like for the ring that I got, it was like, this is what we can afford, and that's that. Like, the 3-month salary thing, that is made up by the diamond industry to sell more diamonds. Like, we got something that we could afford that was still nice looking, right?
Yeah, I mean, mine was paid for by scale insect counting, so you can imagine what my budget was. But I definitely had notes. Like, I had taken notes over the years of what she said she liked in engagement rings and the shape, and it was so squares. She liked square cut stones and kind of like the trifecta of things. But yeah, I didn't know about the 3-month salary thing. That was news to me.
No, I didn't know about that stuff either. These are things I heard after. So, I mean, I don't know. This is not what I was necessarily going to talk about, but when I ended up getting my ring, I was like, okay, whatever, you know. And I think it's the one I like. It's a very small, like, it's a 0.02 diamond, but it was from Tiffany. And my sister was like, to Rodney, like, she's like, you're so dumb. This person that you were going to like ask to marry you wouldn't know the difference between a Tiffany ring and a Walmart ring. Like, why wouldn't you do that? She would not know. And like, he did end up buying me a bigger one because of his family, but I don't wear that one. right? Like, right. So he knew me or whatever. It's like a fleck. It's like the sliverest, littlest thing, but that's what I like.
Yeah. Elegance and simplicity.
Yeah. But I was talking like, so did you give a gift before the wedding? Like, so I didn't know that was a thing either. Right. So, cause I had never planned to get married, but I do remember that Rodney gave me a gift before the wedding. And you want to know what it was?
Absolutely.
Yes.
It was a Dremel.
That's yeah. That's so, your ass out. Yeah.
Right. So, and when, so Dremel is a brand of a power tool, which, yeah. which is very great. So it was what I had on the registry because I really wanted one. You can, you know, grind things, sand things, polish things, etch, mostly etching and cutting, among other things. But my father-in-law or future father-in-law was horrified. And he was like, you never give your spouse something with a cord. Like that was his rule. And of course, Rodney was just like, it's cordless.
Excellent. Excellent retort.
So then his cousins who were very close growing up, they ended up taking him to Jared's, some jewelry place mm-hmm. in North Carolina. I don't know. I think it was like, there's a commercial like Jared's. I don't know.
There is. Yes.
Because he always would sing that. And then they made him buy me earrings, like diamond earrings. And honestly, I don't know where those are.
Right. But you know where your Dremel is.
Yeah. What a versatile tool. Anyway,
Arthropod brought to you by Dremel.
Maybe we'll get a sponsorship yet.
I would be over the moon if Dremel wanted to sponsor the show. That would be hilarious based on Jody's recommendation. That all sounds really wild. I guess I understand some of the wisdom in not wanting to give your spouse a corded object because it's like, here's some chore stuff. Like, here's a way to do work. That could be especially sexist in certain situations, but you asked for the Dremel. That seems to be robbing you of your gift receiving agency. I don't appreciate that.
Well, I asked for it in the registry and not necessarily from Rodney, right?
Right, right.
I mean, I got it, but right. I never heard of that. I don't think I got him anything, to be honest with you, because like.
Some of your in-laws listen to the show, right? So, I mean, maybe they
can. Oh, yeah, yeah. My brother-in-law, he does.
I can honestly say I did not give Kara a gift the day before or the day of our wedding. Like I didn't, the day is supposed to be the gift, I guess, was what I was operating under.
Yeah. You were like, here I am, right?
No, not that. It wasn't that I was the gift. It was just like, you know, this is like a big merry occasion. I don't know. Maybe that's like a poor undergrad's worldview. We got married right after senior year at Purdue. So, there wasn't a lot of excess, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, what would seem like a nice gesture, you know, like gift giving, I suppose, even like from one animal to another, cannot be interpreted the same way in the arthropod world. So, and, you know, it's, we can't like anthropomorphize and give animals these human emotions like, hey, like here's a power tool or whatnot. So this is not a gesture of love, let's say, right? So that's what we're talking about today. We're talking about nuptial gifts, and we can, we can talk about those, but they are going to be different types of gifts. But I think the word is really cool. I mean, a lot of times in entomology, we've got like these big words that we have to explain. So, I mean, today we'll talk about like, what are nuptial gifts in the arthropod world? What role they play? Which arthropods are known to provide and accept nuptial gifts? I'm not necessarily what we can talk about what happens when these gifts are not accepted, because it's not just things without a cord. It's just like it can make a huge difference. I don't know. We can talk a little bit about what you guys know about nuptial gifts and any stories you want to share. Awesome. So there are many different examples of nuptial gift giving in the animal world, and we're going to focus more on the arthropods, but it has been explained in different chapters of there's a lot. If you want to look up anything, you will definitely be able to read for days and years about the nuptial gifts in the animal world. But it's the intersection between sexual selection, because often this is a male and female thing, and it's for mating. It can be about nutrition and about life histories of these organisms. So this behavior is very widespread in animals. You can see that we likely do some sort of that with humans, but there are a lot of different examples. In entomology for arthropods, this behavior is sometimes displayed by certain species where a male offers a gift to a female. This could be during courtship, like, hey, pick me. I have the better gift. I have more to offer you. And then there are also these transference of nuptial gifts, or this gift giving during the process of mating. And so the goal is for the male to pass on his reproductive cells, his gametes, aka sperm, to assure another generation and that he would be the sperm in that offspring. And so these nuptial gifts can be many things. It can be food. So in the insect world, it could be prey. Here's a dead thing. Look what I did for you. This is yummy. And that's going to help you. We always talk about like survival, having, you know, more eggs, more egg production, more success. These can be secretions that is produced by his body. It may contain sperm. It may not. It can contain other materials. It could be wrapped. You know, we wrap gifts. So surprise, yeah. Right? So in that purpose, like Mike said about both of you, about like being purposeful or intentional according to that species is also present. So it's going to be different for different animals. Does anyone want to jump in and say anything about this? I see you covering your face a little bit, Jonathan.
Yeah, I was giggling a little bit. There was a lot of emphasis placed on the word sperm, and I realized that we hadn't put a disclaimer on the front end of the episode. I think that's fine. I mean, when the title is nuptial gifts, it's kind of implicit what we're going to be talking about. So I would just jump in and say, I remember us having long conversations about this several years ago as we prepared for our Sex on Six Legs talks that we did a couple of different times. And I believe the nuptial gift section was under your purview then. So is this something you've always had an interest in, or is it something that you just find kind of cool, or?
I don't remember that part. Okay. So maybe I did it. But the reason this came up is because during our end of the year kind of wrap up that we were doing, we all kind of had an extra one too. And I believe I wanted to talk about a certain spider that was involved in this nuptial gift. It was a pretty interesting and recent, I guess, entomological article. And I think it came up like, hey, we should just do a whole episode about nuptial gifts. And yeah, definitely we could. And so no, it's not something I necessarily thought of a lot or I'm obsessed with, but maybe I am now.
I mean, that's fine. I find it interesting knowing that gifts are not necessarily like forefront of your mind. I don't think any of us would claim to be like, oh yeah, gifts. That's like my love language. Yeah. If you believe in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, mine is definitely not gift accepting either. I mean, right. I can buy my own stuff. If I need it, I go buy it.
Yeah. I mean, you could Dremel it. You could make it yourself probably.
Oh yeah. Kid.
Mike, are you a big gift person?
Oh no, I'm terrible at it. Famously
wait.
Terrible.
Okay, wait. No, wait. Yeah, okay, giving gifts, but do you like to receive gifts? Like, is that something?
I mean, sure, who doesn't like to get a gift?
Okay.
That said, I have very specific tastes, and so it can be difficult for my wife to hit those. So she usually, like, I usually have a list of, like, this is stuff that I like, just to help her out, because otherwise it's like, oh yeah, this thing is great, but it's, like, not exactly what I would have picked myself.
See. I mean, they do heat your taste hue Napoleonic at this point.
They do. She's been real good about that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm excited to learn all about this with you, Jody. I think that this will be cool. I mean, insect mating in of itself, we could do a whole episode on that, but I like this specific peek into the world of, is it males? Is it only males that do this, that they present things to females? Or in your research, did you find examples of females doing this as well?
I mostly found things out about males, but it's really up to, well, there's some kind of decision making in their world, but there is a little bit of like role reversal in some situations. But like, really, I mean, if you think about a peacock, you know, they're showy. They need to be chosen. There are times, and I believe it's like the dance fly, like the male chooses the female, but she still relies on the male to give a gift for her because she can't, I don't think she hunts on her own. So he's got the prey, but he gets to pick. So, you know,
very cool.
Mike.
Oh, can I jump in here? Because Jody sent out a list of like, hey, it'd be great if you could read up on some specific examples. And I picked the dance fly one.
Did you? Okay.
I did, because they're cool. No, so like you said, in most cases, it's the females that are choosy because they're the ones that are investing all the energy in egg production. Like males just have to make sperm and that's cheap. They don't have to make these big expensive eggs. How many times can we say sperm in this episode? We'll see.
A ding.
And so, yeah, like peacocks, it's usually the females that are choosy. But in the one in dance flies, this group, the family Impididae, it's a neat example for these nuptial gifts because you've got ones where males are just out capturing prey and giving it to the females. You have other ones where they'll blow up like a silk sack that has nothing in it and then present that to the females like, hey, I brought you this thing. And then she goes to bite it and there's nothing there. Like it's a fake nuptial gift. Unless maybe they're judging the males based on the quality and size of the big blown up silk bag. So that's cool. But the one that you sent me kind of reverses this. Like you said, the females don't hunt. They'll feed on nectar, but you, like in mosquitoes, nectar is just carbohydrates. There's no protein there for egg production. And so they rely entirely on males like bringing them captured prey to feed on for egg production. So you get these big swarms of females and the male will fly in with his prey and the females inflate their abdomens to make them look like they've got a whole lot of eggs when they don't. And they like put their legs on the side of their body to make themselves look big and fuzzy. And so the fattest, fuzziest females are the ones that get chosen by the male. So the male, because he is bringing the food, the making a higher investment in the progeny, because he's the one out hunting and bringing the protein in, he gets to be the one that's choosy in this system. And there's also a thing, the one paper that you sent, that females, they form these swarms and they're present throughout the entire season. Males are present in low numbers in the beginning. They kind of peak. And then by the end of the season, they are gone and it's just females left. And it's thought that because they're the ones out hunting, they incur greater risk of dying. And so they're gone at the end of the season because they've all been killed. And so you get this like investment, not only in like, I'm bringing you protein sources, but also like I'm dying. So it's a higher risk on their part too. So yeah, like you said, it's a really cool kind of role reversal where the males get to be choosy instead of like peacocks where the females get to be choosy.
Mm-hmm. And in most of the situations that I read, it's mostly, the female gets to pick. But so the purpose of nuptial gifts, okay, so I've got like five reasons or five purposes. I don't know if there are more or they're combined or whatnot, but this is kind of, so this is a courtship display for those males to demonstrate that suitability, because if they can be chosen, that mating is, you can't have a successful mating if they don't choose you first or at all. Not necessarily you're the only one forever, because in the animal world, there's mating with many, many mates. So two, nutritional supplements for the female to produce eggs. And like what Mike was saying with mosquitoes, you know, they do need that blood meal to produce eggs. So there are going to be different nutritional requirements that will help increase survival for those eggs, or, you know, produce more eggs, just have a better fitness. Three, prolonged mating interactions. So if the male is presenting a gift during mating, then they will have like a longer mating time, which may help with sperm transference, again, creating a successful mating and increased like viability of passing on those sperm. Increased success in mating overall, just to have that happen. And then the lower likelihood that females will eat their mates. So in some situations, if the female is needing extra protein or food, there's no something that says like she can't eat him as prey, right? And I think people talk about that with black widow spiders and praying mantises. And I think in some cases, and I didn't read up on this, like there are some insects that I don't know if they sacrifice themselves, or it's like, hey, like you can eat me, like I've already made it, and this will ensure the success of my offspring.
It feels like people feel that way about mantises, right? Like they feel like the male gives himself up or something to that effect in order to mate. There doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence for that necessarily, but that's sort of the conception that people have, is he's like, whatever, I get to be a dad. So he'll let her immobilize him and eat him.
I was going to ask along those lines, like if a male mantis is eaten by the female and that increases the fitness of her offspring, she can make, you know, she gets this big meal and so she can produce more eggs and they have better success. Like, would her feeding on him, like if I'm the male giving myself up, like, is that a nuptial gift then? Like, I am the nuptial gift that you are eating as we mate.
That's a good question. I don't know. And have you guys seen praying mantises mating?
Fairly frequently. I've never seen a male get eaten.
Well, it's usually just his head's missing. And he's probably just as successful without a head. Like, she just carries on with her day. She's still, you know, catching flies and bees and stuff. And he's still attached to her. And I've seen it with both, like, the Chinese mantis and the Carolina mantis. And it's pretty interesting. And then, like, I just kept watching to see if she would eat the rest of them. And she didn't. Like, I just found this body later on. So I just maybe thought it wasn't really for nutrition. It was just probably because he was annoying.
Talk too much.
Like, you know, maybe, I don't know. It didn't seem like that was a nuptial gift, like an intentional gift giving thing.
Fair enough. I guess I don't know if it meets the parameters, right? Like, he's not acquiring extra things. I don't know if that counts, yeah. Right? If it's just yourself where you're like, yeah, baby.
Yeah. And And I don't know how like that those females choose or choosy with the male.
We are engaging in a lot of anthropomorphization.
True. Yeah. Like just what show. So also what Mike had mentioned is that, you know, so if sperm's not that expensive or costly to produce, like these nuptial gifts are. And so it requires these males to have like a certain level of health and size and strength and speed to be able to catch these prey items or carry them around, fly around with them, and then present them. So, you know, it could be more of an honest thing where we were talking about like puffing up your body to make it look like you could produce more eggs, pick me. So I think they call it like honest portrayal. And that's why with spiders, maybe wrapping that nuptial gift in silk is could be a way to deceive. It could be something that's presented in a way that is more attractive because it's a bigger, let's say, like physical package. And so those bigger ones would be, yeah, it's the size of your package, I suppose. We can put
we'll lose our clean tag real quick.
I want a disclaimer on this. I'll edit it.
No, I like it. The gloves are off. I think the outro song is going to be Baby Got Back or something at this point. That reminds me of the one that I read about in preparation for the show. I think maybe you were alluding to it before, the nursery web spiders and their gift giving ritual. Is that what you were interested in last December, Jody?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Because it wasn't very honest in some cases, right?
I guess the part that I read about was more about their preference for giving larger packages. The female for receiving larger packages, even. The nursery web spiders, this is from an Entomology Today article by Adrienne Antonsen. It was written for Valentine's Day in 2020, so in the before times. It was about how males often present females with silk-wrapped prey items before copulation. The nuptial gifts lower the likelihood that the females will eat the males, increase the length of time females permit copulation, and improve fertilization success, all of the parameters you mentioned before. There was a study that showed males prefer to present females with larger gifts, even if they themselves are less healthy. They ones that were less healthy, though, they were discovered to nip at the gift a little bit before they turned it over, though. They helped themselves. And then she ends this section by saying, it's the thought that counts, though, right? Like, if your spouse showed up and gave you a quarter eaten quarter pounder, would you still be like, okay, yeah, you can come inside.
Thanks for that. Thanks for leaving me a bite. Like, I'll eat what you don't eat type thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was that one. The other one was, it's funny because I'll have to bleep this out, but my title, or like when I was doing the end of the year thing, was male spiders that offer shitty non-existent nuptial gifts to females. That's how I felt about it. But it was not more like, I guess it was like wrapping up the leftovers, if you're still going on the quarter pounder thing. Wrapping up the leftovers in silk to entice this female attraction, but it's basically worthless. But right. It's like, and these are I can't even say the scientific name. Trichilidae family. They live in Central and South America. Yeah. Thank you. They resemble fishing spiders or long-legged water spiders, but they're known for the silk wrapping package. So presented from the males to the female as part of the courtship to woo those females. And so again, it lowers the likelihood that she will eat the males and increases the length of time that she will permit him to copulate, and then therefore improve and also provides this nutrition for the female. But the males, spiders will give females the worthless gift that have no value when it is supposed to be nutritive. So if it's wrapped nicely, so it's the deception, it still might work. So it's kind of cheating. And so the scientists had the researchers, let's see, it's the Dr. Maria Albo and her team, study these spiders. And the males had the option of wrapping a dead fly, which would be the food, or a worthless empty casing left of a beetle larvae. And so the male invests more time wrapping up the worthless gift, so it takes longer for the female to open it. And then he can mate with her. It's deception all the way. He also holds on to it so he can, like, I don't know. It's interesting, but they did stressful versus unstressful environments. And so they found that Males carry worthless gifts around 38% of the time when they're not stressed, but in stressful populations, it's going to be more deception. So they are going to present a worthless gift 96% of the time. So really the males, even though they want to mate, they are still focused on survival. So they're going to keep the food for themselves instead of offer that to the females. What do you think about that?
It's like a parable almost. Like there's a folk tale mixed up in there somewhere.
I was trying to come up with a joke about stressful environments. Like they're, I don't know, the boss is coming down hard on these spiders, and so they're giving crappy gifts out.
It's just like
finals week.
Yeah, I couldn't come up with something though.
Finals week. So you just wrap up like an old toilet paper tube and you're like, yeah, no, this'll work.
I mean, it would be really interesting to do some kind of research like that. Like just have a bunch of different things and what would be more valuable, what's more highly, you know, nutritious, and like, here, have this, wrap that up, give that. They call that honest signaling. So, you know, that only individuals in good physical conditions can produce high quality gifts. So if you're giving a high quality gift, it's a reflection of your high quality, your individual quality as a mate, I suppose. And then there were some studies that were trying to determine if females can assess the gift content. And in some cases, they were unable to assess that value of that gift. So, you know, they were not able to tell that they were worthless. If they did during, then maybe they could shorten copulation during that if they were presented with a small or low quality gift. But most times it's really, it is going to be, you know, stimulated or chosen by the female. So what makes a better gift? So that nuptial feeding, so the food, nutrition can positively influence female fitness. So she is usually going to want to prefer a male with larger gifts. And then the chemical makeup for those gifts could be a number of things that will give that female and the eggs the edge when it comes to survival. So there have been known to be many, many things packed inside these nutritional nuptial gifts, proteins, minerals, carbs, carbohydrates, lipids, and also defense chemicals. And so I kind of got into reading about blister beetles and then these fire-colored beetles. And it was so interesting because it went from like, nuptial gifts, yes, but where do they get this cantharidin if they don't have it in their body naturally, like these fire-colored beetles? But they do get them from blister beetles. So it's like they're getting these things, the substance the blister beetles make, they have it, they use it as a nuptial gift. And so it's just like this thing that gets passed on. So I guess we should talk about blister beetles first. So blister beetles can synthesize cantharidin, which is a terpene or terpenoid, and it's also called the Spanish fly. And humans think about Spanish fly because they think it's an aphrodisiac, and it makes like the females want to have sex and the males to have, I don't know, like a long-lasting erection?
Erection, yeah.
That. Okay. Now I'm all, I can't. I didn't really think about this not being a family show for some reason. I didn't know this was going to spin that way. Okay.
It's fine. We can talk about like...
I mean, yeah, it's just biology. Okay. We're not sensationalizing it.
I know, but it's... That's not what I was thinking that I was talking about.
This is
about
not
today.
Your intention?
So, well, no, not really. I thought it was more like gift giving, but now it's different things. Like
I mean, that's what happens after the gift is given.
It's true. So it was found. Oh, so cantharidin, it causes blisters. That's why we call those the blister beetles. And that substance is found throughout all the fluids in the blister beetle. And then it does cause blistering. We don't want people to touch blister beetles when they're picking them off their vegetables and whatnot. And I know, especially in Kentucky, they are very where there are horses and cattle and anything feeding on hay that could have blister beetles in them. You don't want that there because it's can be deadly, right? It's going to cause a bunch of problems.
It's really bad for the horses, yeah.
It causes spontaneous abortions, right?
That was something else that, or if you're talking about mare reproductive loss syndrome, but is that what you were referring to, or just like in general?
No, just in general.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's like blisters in the tongue and mouth, right? Like renal damage, gastrointestinal issues, and possibly death. So I know that you probably deal with that. I know I mentioned that when I talk about blister beetles. Anyway, so the cantharidin is synthesized in the blister beetles, and evidently the fire-colored beetle, which is in a different family, they do not produce their own cantharidin, but they get it from climbing onto blister beetles and ingesting it from them. They're immune to it, or they're very attracted to the cantharidin. And then, so in, I think it was like 1996, Dr. Thomas Eisner found that these males of the fire-colored beetle present this fluid from the gland of their heads to the female, just a little bit. It's like a little taster, like you're at Costco or Sam's Club, and you're just like, oh, walking by, like, hey, try this. You would never, ever buy it, whatever.
Sparkling cantharidin, ma'am?
Yes, let me try it. Here, let me take that little toaster up and give it to you. And then you're like, yes, I'm going to buy that. So then when she ends up picking that male mate that has offered this cantharidin, then, you know, during the mating, so that's just a fraction of what he has to offer. When they are mating, he transfers more, and then those make the eggs, I guess, poisonous and protected from predators that may eat those eggs. So that is going to be able to ensure the survival of their offspring. So it's advantageous for both the male and the female. So that's her reward if she chooses him.
And is it, if you can make more of it, you get a better success at mating, or just, you just need to have some?
You just have to have some. Yeah. And so I think that there was some research that showed if the male didn't have any cantharidin, then she was not interested at all.
Just pass on that guy.
That. Yeah. So, yes, but I thought it was interesting that they can't make it on their own. So they have to get it from blister beetles. But do not get Spanish fly, even though if you do see something that has that, it's probably a placebo because like FDA, and it's not good for you. So and going back to, I guess, researching, the crushed up, dried up dead beetles, that warm, fuzzy feeling was not love. That was inflammation.
Right.
Urinary tract.
Yeah. Eisner, I mean, he's done quite a bit with cantharidin. I think it was him. I'd have to go back and look, but he was the one that brought to light the report from the French Foreign Legion about ingesting frogs that had eaten blister beetles. Mike, do you know what I'm talking about?
I have never heard about that, but now I want to know more.
We'll have to do some digging, but I'm pretty sure it was Eisner that brought this report to light, that there was a French physician that wrote about a string of strange priapism cases in soldiers in the French Foreign Legion, and it involved eating frogs that had consumed the blister beetles. So like they were secondhand getting this chemical inside of them, and they were ending up with painful, long-lasting erections sort of spontaneously.
This sounds like you could be a whole arthropod episode on it.
I'm
just throwing it out there.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because it's not new, right? Like it's
George Washington took Spanish fly, I'm pretty sure. So yeah, like this is something we've been messing with for a long time.
Yeah, it's like the Roman Empire, and like there's so many people that died from this, and it's definitely not something you want to take or want to have, this cantharidin. But you know, when it comes to, it's interesting that this is nuptial gift giving,
I just found it. I'll put it in the chat, but we don't have to talk about it anymore.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, it will induce, it could induce warm feelings, but that's not love. For other beetles too, fireflies or lightning bugs, whatever you want to call them, they also give nuptial gifts. And this is when we could talk about like a spermatophore. Do you want to explain what that is?
Yeah, I think Mike ought to do that. I mean, that really seems like one of his fortes.
Spermatophores are my forte, yeah. You're saying?
Yeah. It's on your CV, I thought.
No.
Skills. Spermatophore education.
No, but I guess I can. No, spermatophores come in all kinds of different shapes and sizes. That.
Yeah, they do.
So this is a giggly episode. And depending on what the insect is doing, they vary by usage. So they don't always contain a nuptial gift. They always contain sperm, like their sperm transfer mechanism. They're using a whole lot of different insect and non-insect groups. So like springtails use spermatophores for sperm transfer. They'll put a little spermatophore packet down and like they'll find a female and bring her over and be like, here it is, sit on it. And she'll take it up that way. But in some cases, males will add, like in addition to sperm, they'll add like other stuff. Like you were mentioning with the cantharidin, they can do that. They'll add nutrition. So katydids are a great example. Like they'll produce a big spermatophore and the sperm bit goes into the female for the fertilization, but like there's a big kind of gelatinous addition onto the spermatophore that hangs out of her reproductive orifice. And she'll like bend down and eat the gelatinous nutrition packed part of the spermatophore that is like hanging out of her after mating. And it's a way to get nutrition transfer in addition to like the sperm transfer. So there's all kinds of other stuff that you can do with spermatophores too, like you mentioned, defensive compounds. And sometimes they're like in dragonfly spermatophores are used, they block up the reproductive tract of the female, so you mate and it blocks everything up so another male can't come along and mate with her. And sometimes that's combined with nutrition. So like you get this mating plug that's made by a spermatophore, but also like there's a bunch of nutrition in there that then gets absorbed. So yeah, they have all kinds of different kind of uses and depending on what is being packaged in that spermatophore along with the sperm itself.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. The nuptial gift can either be delivered orally, like they're feeding one another or feeding the recipient, or delivered genitally, or can some cases it be absorbed through the exoskeleton? Is that another option?
Oh, I don't know about through the exoskeleton, but certainly like through the reproductive tract where it's
right.
More membranous and less chitiny.
Kind of makes sense that it would happen there.
Yeah, like internal transfer. So for the fireflies, there's a Dr. Sarah Lewis. She's a professor of biology at the School of Arts and Science at Tufts. She has studied firefly sex lives for a really long time. It's pretty cool. Her 2016 research talked about the molecular characterization of what was in the nuptial gifts of fireflies. So they found over 200 identifiable proteins in the nuptial gift. And these enzymes were found to help with fertilization and egg development and ovulation, and could increase the amount of eggs that a female could lay, increase like the sperm storage, immune system, all these different things. And she also found that it contained leucobufagin, which is a fun word to say, which is that bitter tasting toxic compound that protects the firefly eggs and the adults. So that is, again, that defensive chemical that will help against predators. She was also, after I read that, was a guest on the Ologies podcast, which was pretty funny. And they called it Sparkle Buttology because she had asked, I guess, like, what ology is that? And she said Sparkle Buttology. And that's how I remember that, because I thought that was hilarious. But it's just like this extra package full of nutrients, like a protein packed capsule of sperm. Like, who doesn't want that gift, right? So, but they found that the males that had these larger nuptial gifts had more desirable flashes. So they could signal that to the female. And one of the things like that she had mentioned is like that fireflies / lightning bugs are so cool because we as humans can see all of this happening, right? they can learn about this and then manipulate it with like artificial lights and things like that. So that was pretty cool. But the females that accept these males, choose these males and accept these nuptial gifts will have more eggs, stronger and better offspring, higher lifetime egg production, increased lifespan. And then those males will, you know, sire the most offspring. So nuptial gifts in the firefly world.
No, I think I keep thinking about the deceptive versus like honest signaling that these nuptial gifts can do. Because thinking about the dance flies that I was reading about, I mentioned the ones that just create the silk bags, right? They're just air. There's nothing there to eat. But, and we look at that and we're like, well, that's a crappy nuptial gift. You're not actually giving that female anything, but there is signal there. Like, you're saying, hey, I make a bigger bag than Joe Schmo down the street. Like, pick me because I can produce this bigger, better thing. So even though it's empty, there's no like nutrition there. It's still like an honest signal that she can look at and determine mate quality. And it's interesting that that can vary so much across these different groups. Like in the fireflies, there's an honest signal there because the nuptial gift quality correlates to flash size. But like in spiders, that may or may not be the case because they can wrap it up and hide it. Mm-hmm. But in other silk producing things, like it is honest because the size is what matters and not necessarily like what's in there.
It's also really elastic, right? Like what if there is a bad year for food? I mean, at least there's going to be some survivability because you've got these like low-key liars that trick people a little bit, or trick females, I guess, in this mm-hmm. case, a little bit, and keep things going. Like, it makes sense to me that this is a trait that would be passed on.
Right. And if, like, if you could, well, the thing is, like, if you were to wrap, like, you still need a certain level of fitness to be able to, like, wrap, like, worthless gifts in silk, right? Like, it's going to take time still. So it's, like, the trade-off between, like, wrapping something really crappy or like finding something really big and wrap, like, I don't know. It's still gonna be some kind of, I guess, I don't know, signaling there to be like, hey, like I'm better than nothing. Look at what I'm giving you.
Yeah.
It's just neat how much variation there is. Like within the signaling and like males and females doing different things, depending on the system. Like there's just so much to kind of pick apart. It's a neat topic and a neat system, I think.
I'm really glad that gift wrapping is not a part of a selection, especially if I didn't have like the grid lines on the back of the paper as you're cutting it. I would be in dire straits.
Man, I remember the paper as a kid that didn't have grid lines, and I can't believe it took us so long to come up with that.
Yeah.
That's why I like gift bags, and you can recycle those as well.
I feel like gift bags are the fakers of the dance flies.
Yes, you like, put a lot of fluff in it. It's really a big bag. It's got this like little half-eaten quarter pounder.
there's a half-eaten apple at the center of like 2 pounds of wrapping paper, gift paper.
Yeah,
I save all of the gift bags because I always think like, oh, we'll reuse these. And then I just have a bag of bags in my attic.
Yeah, that's a pretty common cultural experience.
Well, you can't put them in the attic. That's, you have to have them like, I reuse them a lot for basically anything. Sorry if it says the wrong thing on it, or the wrong name, but I
do. Happy birthday. It's Christmas.
It's a boy.
How did you bring this to my 40th birthday?
I didn't do any like reading about the aphids, but evidently there's like a mating drop or droplet of some nutrient rich fluid. Either of you know about nuptial gifts and aphids? No, I don't know. No. Evidently obtain nutrients for essential reproduction. I couldn't find anything looking for it. I did see something that had like giant water bug. Maybe he, oh, is that what you were going to talk about?
I just was excited about that because I found that quite fascinating. Do you want to set it up?
No.
Okay.
Because I don't want to ruin the joke. Like if there's...
It's not a joke. No, we're on the same wavelength. What happens there?
Well, the male... Yeah, well, I'm just going to ruin it for you. So like the male courtship, I believe like he offers her some prey. And since they're, you know, these predaceous, I guess, true bugs in the water, it could be fish, could be something. What I don't want to ruin your thing.
There is no ruining, Jody.
Oh, but for the males, they do take care of the eggs. So if she chooses him, if he's got good prey or whatever, that's part of the courtship ritual. So then he will let her lay eggs on his wing covers. He stops feeding. He protects those eggs, spends time. So it shows her, the female, that he's going to be a really good, like, paternal device, I guess.
Solid guy. One of the papers that I read about it also, they did this. I don't know how natural this experiment is, but they would glue eggs on top of the males. Not like a bunch of them, but then they would present the females with the males, and the females showed a strong preference for males that were already exhibiting paternal behavior. So if they were like, if they looked like good dads already, then they were more likely to choose them. And then on the opposite side of the coin, the males showed a really strong preference for bigger females because of the dimorphism there. They are a lot smaller than the females. So they wanted like, I don't know, a big mama. And she wanted a good dad.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's another,
I mean, those things, this is where it gets, I think, a little fuzzy. Like, that's not really a nuptial.
No, it would be the prey. I would think the nuptial gifts is like, here's the prey. That was and that's more like courting.
Sexual selection, right? Like, like the courtship and the ritual. I mean, there is some fuzziness there because you sent something about dung beetles as well, where there's like a male competition where whoever's got the biggest and baddest ball of dung, that's who the female will choose in this one species we'll include in the show notes. But like, isn't that also sexual selection, like competitively, almost like eye stalk flies? I don't know. Like, am I crossing too many wires
it's
there?
It's true. I mean, there's got to be some boundary, but... Like when you look up nuptial gifts, these things kind of come in to it, you know, because it's part of it. But do you want to talk about scorpion flies, Mike?
I do, because they're my favorite order of insects.
Okay. Tell us all about them.
No, that's why I picked it. So there's a couple examples, and I went with the Panorpa, just kind of the regular old scorpion flies. There's a genus of wingless scorpion flies out in California that also do mating gifts, but I didn't look into that one so much. But just in the regular old scorpion flies, in at least one species in Europe, and I think species here do it too, the males will produce like a salivary gift. So they're not out catching anything. They're producing this nuptial gift with like spit. And the bigger the ball of spit that they present to the female, it takes her longer to feed on it. And while they're mating, the length of the mating determines how much sperm he transfers, because it's kind of a continual transfer of sperm throughout the duration. So the bigger ball of spit that he provides, the bigger nuptial gift, means that he gets to mate for longer and transfer more sperm. And like some of these other groups that we've talked about, scorpion flies will mate with multiple mates. And the way the eggs are fertilized is that it's just a scramble competition. So if you have more sperm in that female, she'll kind of let them all the sperm from all the males go at the same time. So if you have more sperm in there, you will fertilize more eggs than a competitor that has less sperm.
So it's like a lottery, like the more tickets you buy, instead of like the last sperm precedence.
Right, right. It's a scramble instead of like first in, first fertilized, or last in, first fertilized. So the longer you can mate with her, the more tickets you get, the more chances you get to fertilize those eggs. And so the size of the nuptial gift correlates directly to, you know, your chances of fertilizing the offspring. So it's another one of these like really honest signals, because it's like, he's not signaling per se, but like, it just is like, she feeds longer. And so he gets more chances at fertilizing eggs. And I also thought it was neat. Like it's a different, like they are like predators and detritivores. They'll feed on like dying and recently dead insects. So you would think like it could be a system where they're like presenting a captured insect, right? But no, they don't do that. They make this spitball, which is kind of cool. Also, scorpion flies are neat in general. So they're a cool system.
What do they have, a scorpion tail?
Yeah. So in some scorpion flies, it's hard to not anthropomorphize them, right? But in some groups, there is no nuptial gift, and the females will just grab the males and mate with them. And so it's kind of an antagonistic mating system in some groups. Mm-hmm. I hesitate to call it rapey because, like, they're not humans, right? There's no consent in insects, but like the females are trying to get away, and the males just grab them and mate with them. In some groups, but in other groups, like the ones with nuptial gifts, the females will choose and they will mate longer on purpose because the gifts are bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the wingless ones, I think that one was like, there is also like a salivary packet, but they can also package a dead insect, and she may not be impressed by the size of it. And so like he could actually like steal it back and eat it himself.
Oh, you're not going to let me mate with you? I'm taking my burger.
Yeah. It's just like, I'm going to take this back and I need that. So like, I think it was like, if he's in good shape, he's pretty healthy, he can create the salivary mass, but if he's not in good health, then he could offer a dead insect and then, see if she mates with him. And if not, he can take it back, steal it back, eat it himself, whatnot. But I think one of the other things we were talking about is like what those requirements are. And so do you guys know about that imported cabbage worm? I did not know. Or the, what do we call this? Cabbage white. It's cabbage, the butterfly, white. Right? So evidently we can't see it. It's like the insect sight, but the females can look at the males and determine if by his coloration, if he is like got a lot of nitrogen. So they really need nitrogen. So males have one dot on their forewings, a black dot on their, for us, it looks like this kind of white butterfly, and the females have two. So like nitrogen is really important. And so the nuptial gift that the male gives the female and is passed during mating, so this is internally, is their source of energy, is also nitrogen needed for that wing pigmentation. So she can tell if the male has good sources of nitrogen due to wing pigmentation. However, in some environments, that female may not need nitrogen. So the experiment here was to get a population of cabbage white butterflies from like an agricultural setting environment and one not from an agricultural setting. So the egg site had higher availability of nitrogen, and it found that if she doesn't need it, she will not be receptive to mating. So that's really environmental like differences. So also in terms of being able to break down the nitrogen in the reproductive tract, they have like some kind of tooth structure, and the females in that agricultural setting does not have, or has a reduced structure.
Oh, cool.
So it's very interesting.
Yeah. So like the use of nuptial gifts varies depending on female fitness and what's in the environment. That's
right.
Cool.
So yeah, and they thought like because in the agricultural setting there's like a lot of fertilizer, so it makes it nitrogen rich, so they don't need to mate with like the nuptial gifts is no good here.
That makes me think of one of the bird systems. Is it might be cardinals, but it might also be one of the other red birds. Male coloration is correlated to health and fitness because like they have to go feed on these red berries and like that's where they're getting the red pigmentation for their feathers. And so the brighter the red, like the better fit they are, until we introduced invasive honeysuckle, which also produce red berries and are all over the place. And so after the introduction of that, like just all the males are bright red and females have a harder time discriminating because like this invasive plant is allowing all males, regardless of their fitness, to like have really good coloration. Not that it's a nuptial gift, but it's interesting like how we can change environments in like with the butterflies, we're increasing nitrogen. And so now the females don't care as much. Like we have this input and we're screwing up animal mating systems.
Like if we related to humans, like during the pandemic when there was a shortage of toilet paper, like if it's like, hey, I'm single, like I got a trailer full of toilet paper, come be with me. You could be like, I guess so.
Just imagining that scenario where you like fawns elbow a trailer, like a horse trailer, and the gate falls down and you're like, check out my Charmin.
What do you got here? Wow. Right.
What do you bring to the table?
Yeah, and like in different environments when there's like a depletion, you never know what kind of gifts will be more valuable at the time.
Well, I think this has been a really awesome tour of the world of nuptial gifts, Jody. Thank you for that. Thank you for compiling all that information. Is there anything else you want to say to kind of put a bow on top of your gift here today?
No.
No? Okay. I can't think of anything. We've got some cool resources we'll include in the show notes that you've compiled. People can check this out. And we hope people will sound off if they know anything about nuptial gifts that they would like to contribute. So if you want to do that, you can find us on your various favorite podcatcher apps. We're Arthro-Pod on all of those podcatcher apps. If you don't include the dash, you won't be able to find us. You can find us on Spotify most often, Podcast Addict, all those different things. And we appreciate ratings and reviews there and questions and comments if you can submit them. You can also find the show on Twitter, Arthro_Pod Show. And each of your hosts are on that platform, ostensibly. I am Bugman John.
I'm at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
I'm at mscavarla36 on Twitter and at Napoleonic Ento on Blue Sky.
And you've been reporting that Blue Sky is kind of trending towards having some bug communities and stuff that people can join up in, right?
Yeah, the two communities on Twitter that I was kind of most following or most involved with were comics and science. And at least the entomology side and kind of the broader science side, as well as the comics. So it seems like the creatives and the scientists have, like, those communities are starting to reform on Blue Sky. Not everybody's there, but I'm starting to see a lot of, like, the familiar, I guess not faces, the familiar avatars.
Andals and avatars.
Yeah. From folks that, like, were on Twitter and are now over on Blue Sky. So it's nice to, like, see those communities kind of coming back together without some of the problems that Twitter has developed in the last year.
Yes, very much so. We appreciate you all for listening. Tune in a couple of weeks for another exciting Arthropod episode, and we'll catch you then and there.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
We can just see what happens. Who knows?